Before we start, everybody should have a copy of the dialogue questions, and I've basically given you a sampler of some of these gentlemen's writings. Because of copyright issues, I can't give you any more than that, but I really do invite you to read the work that's alluded to just by the front pages of those articles, which are at the back of that booklet. So it's my pleasure now to conclude the program by introducing you to the two panelists on my right, as we spoke about earlier today. Dr. David Berger is the head of Jewish Studies at Yeshiva College, is the former Brooklynian professor of Jewish history at Brooklyn College, is the author of several highly regarded books, including Jewish Christian Debate in the High Middle Ages. And to my left, Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, who is the associate rabbi at Kiel Jeshurun and is an associate fellow at the Shalem Center, is completing right now his doctorate at Princeton University. We wanted to bring these gentlemen together because both of them have been so intimately involved with issues of interfaith dialogue and discussions about what is appropriate or possibly inappropriate to talk about with Christians. And I wanted to begin with just a basic question about what you think should be the goals of interfaith dialogue, and I wanted to be more specific about that. We could talk with Christians about what we think unites us with them, basic issues of morality or support for the state of Israel, but we could also talk about what might be different about us, and this enters onto the realm of theology, about our different conceptions of truth, most obviously with the great divide of the status of Jesus, of course, who's rejected by Jews as the Messiah and or divine, or conceptions of forgiveness, which are very different. And I'm wondering what you think would be the best route to take, and I'll begin with Dr. Berger.
There's obviously going to be overlap among these questions. And so the first question impinges significantly on the question dealing with Rabbi Soloveitchik's confrontation. There is a certain potential value in discussing theological questions about which we differ. However, I don't think that there is enough of a value in doing that in the context of interfaith dialogue for it to be worth the problems that it can cause. Now, that doesn't mean that we should discuss only things that we agree about. There are all sorts of things that aren't that don't involve a fundamental theological divide about which we don't necessarily agree. There are certain moral questions regarding which we have the same framework, but where Jews and certain kinds of Christians might disagree, and we have to keep in mind that there are differences among Christians. To take one example, which I don't want to belabor, abortion is a moral question. Perspective on this issue of Orthodox Jews, even though there are differences among Orthodox Jews too, on the precise parameters, and Catholics would run in a different direction from differences between Orthodox Jews and non-evangelical Protestants. So that there is enough to discuss in the realm of social issues, political issues, and moral issues, which are the ones that are closest to theology. And we'll discuss later the question of how one category bleeds into another, to have a fruitful discussion without addressing questions that are essentially questions of religious polemic. And if we're going to discuss with Christians in the context of a dialogue intended to increase friendship, interfaith amity, which is ultimately the objective of these discussions. These discussions have, or I think should have, a practical intent. If we're going to start talking about whether we think Jesus is the Messiah or not, or whether we think Jesus is divine or not, I think that that aside from the fact that the conversation would probably be fruitless, it could also result in consequences just the opposite of what such a discussion is intended to produce.
I absolutely agree. I'll just add two very brief points. When we talk about interfaith dialogue, usually that means, and I assume the question refers to interfaith dialogue on a public communal level, in which representatives of, say, the Orthodox Jewish community and representatives of the Catholic Church or of the Evangelical Protestant community get together to discuss issues of comedy and difference, et cetera, et cetera. And there, I think we are, as we'll discuss later, bound and rightly bound by the guidelines set for Rav Soloveitchik by Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik Zatzal. I completely agree with Dr. Berger that there is a tremendously rich and, I would say, neglected to some extent. There's much more that we could be talking about in terms of our moral, in terms of our own moral commonalities as well as differences. That could bear much more fruit, I think, than getting together as representatives of large communities to come together to come up with some list of agreements about or disagreements about expressly theological issues such as the identity of Jesus, etc., etc. I would just add that it's important to distinguish between interfaith dialogue on a public communal level and interfaith conversation and dialogue on a more personal level. So there's no question that Rav Soloveitchik himself was very well read and I think probably learned a great deal, one could say, from reading Christian theologians and Christian theology. And there were those originally who, when writing about Rav Soloveitchik's ban on Orthodox interfaith dialogue on a communal level, who asked the question of, how could Rav Soloveitchik himself engage in discussions and clearly learn a great deal from Christians? So it must be, and this is taken on various forms, but the suggestion has been made that it must be that really Rav Soloveitchik had no problem with interfaith dialogue. It's just that some have even gone so far as to suggest these were Orthodox Jews who wrote these articles, that he felt guilty about his own study of Christian theology, so he banned it on an outer level. And I think it's precisely the opposite, that Rav Soloveitchik, I think, presciently recognized that when we're discussing matters on a communal public level, then there's a great deal to be concerned about, and I think his concerns have been borne out when we get together on a communal level and seek to find some areas of commonality or shared theological language when it comes to expressly theological issues like the Messiah or worship and other things like that. At the same time, it doesn't mean that I think Rav Soloveitchik recognized, and one sees that in reading his writings, that doesn't mean that when we study Christian theology about expressly religious matters that there's nothing to gain. It doesn't mean it's not dangerous in certain cases either, as Professor Berger mentioned before. Like other pursuits, there's dangers to it, but it can still be a fruitful endeavor.
What do you think changes from private to public? In other words, if we all concede that on a private level, if we talk to Christians, and all of us have, I teach Catholics about religious pedagogy, and I learn an enormous amount from them about my own Judaism, in fact. So if we personally can see that there's great value that accrues from that, What happens in that shift to the public level that you think makes it more problematic?
Well, I have my own suggestion. I'd love to hear what Dr. Berger says. But as I understand Rav Soloveitchik's concerns, and I think they've been borne out, I think the point is the following. On the one hand, it doesn't mean that when Rav Soloveitchik has concerns about interfaith engagement, doesn't mean that we have nothing to learn from reading each other. When I went to Yale Divinity School, so I showed up the first day, and I was aware that I was very possibly the first Orthodox rabbi to ever go to Yale Divinity School. And most of them at orientation went into the chapel for a Christian service, and I shuffled uncomfortably around outside. And then we all came in to, they all sat on the lawn, and we told stories about ourselves and about our lives. We sat in circles. So one of the students, some very sincere pastor from the Dakotas, North Dakota, South Dakota, whatever. So he said, something like, I really feel like I stick out here at Divinity School, being a Presbyterian among so many Episcopalians. So then meanwhile, the guy in the yarmulke, was thinking, yeah, I hate when that happens. That's the worst when you're Presbyterian, everyone's Episcopalian. But then they asked me why I came, and I said, in college I had studied the writings of Christian philosophers who had written about philosophical defenses of religious issues, philosophical defenses of miracles, faith, etc. And they were, to a great extent, the only people writing about it in an academy in which belief was very often seen with scorn. And they all nodded, and they understood completely what I meant, and there was a real bond and a connection. This doesn't mean, incidentally, that they can't have more public forums and more public discussions or lectures. I think Rav Soloveitchik's Lonely Man of Faith was delivered, at a Boston seminary. But when you're gathering together for the express purpose of communal agreement and commonality, then, by definition, the social setting itself and the language and the sensitivity involved come together in a very bad concoction. Because what ends up happening is, in the search for commonalities, we might take the temptation to take very private and deeply held beliefs and sacrifice them on the altar of commonality is just, and to come back and have a press conference and say, well, we have this list of statements that we can have, is not just too tempting, but almost, says Rav Soloveitchik, inevitable.
You're afraid that there'll be compromise? That they'll compromise?
Compromise? Well, one of two things. Either compromise, right? Or, right, that's like the joke, about the Catholic and the Protestant and the Jew get together and say we should all start one religion to end religious division. So the Catholic says, great idea. The Protestant says, good idea. We'll do away with the concept of the Trinity. And the Catholic says, great idea. We'll do away with the doctrine of Mary's Immaculate Conception. And the Jew says, great idea. We'll be willing to get rid of the second Yukum Purkan in the Siddur. So the point is, sometimes there's a great deal of pressure on the one hand to come together to find commonality, or conversely to relativize disagreement, to say, well, we do seem to disagree, but really what's true for you is true for you, what's true for us is true for us. Both of those are terrible temptations.
All right, so let me say a few things about this, some of which I thought we would talk about later when we get to our Soloveitchik. I won't say everything that I think needs to be said right away, but one or two comments. First of all, I can't, I try not to do this, but talk about looking out of place. Many years ago, I was brought by a neighbor of mine in Queens who was in Israel at the time to the Gerer Minyan for Mincha of Shabbos. And then from there, he took me to Karlin Stolen for Kabbalah Shabbos. But in Gerer, wear sort of longish black coats, but basically a black head up and black hats, nothing, especially unusual. In that minyan, there was a fellow wearing one of those multicolored robes with the stripes from, Tal Basaran or wherever it was, or Virelis Chassidim. I turned to this fellow from Kew Gardens Hills who had brought me there, and I pointed at that fellow and I said, he looks out of place. And my neighbor turns to me and he said, you want to know who looks out of place? With respect to the issue that is before us, I do think that that context matters profoundly. And sometimes it's difficult to draw lines. For example, this is not yet the time to talk about this. Maybe there's no time to talk about this right here. But there was recently a crisis in Jewish-Catholic relations, which has, I think, been resolved, not according to everyone, but I think it's been resolved remarkably. But in any case, there is a discussion scheduled to take place in Georgetown University about Jewish and Christian conceptions of mission. And there is also a discussion, an official religious dialogue, which is being planned at JTS by the National Council of Synagogues and the Catholic and Catholic representatives. Now, the one in Georgetown is an academic setting, but it is labeled a religious dialogue. It's a hybrid entity. And when the crisis was still at its was unresolved, I was asked to comment on presentations by the previous director of the Jewish desk of the U.S. Council of Conference of Catholic Bishops and about John Paul II, and a paper by the current executive director of that body about Benedict XVI, both about the Jews. And I had it settled to go. They want me to comment on this. I said, I really struggled about it because on one level it's academic, on another level it's labeled a dialogue. And it was in the midst of this moment when it wasn't so clear we could continue discussing things with them almost at all. I shared my inner struggle with the Catholic fellow who had invited me from Georgetown. And in the end I said no. I just got an email from him 2 days ago saying, have things changed now? Can you come? I don't know. I doubt that I will. But it shows that there, you know, sometimes the aegis under which something takes place makes a critical difference. I'm willing to talk to Catholics. I'm more than willing to talk to them in an academic setting. Because in an academic setting, I'm not representing the Jewish community. I'm not speaking for Jews. I'm not saying what the Jewish position should be. The relevance of that difference I can illustrate in the following story, which is very relevant to the Rav's position as well. A number of years ago, the National Council of... I guess this is relevant to another later question, too. The New York Board of Rabbis, which is an interdenominational group, invited its members to attend an interfaith prayer service for peace in the main sanctuary of St. Patrick's Cathedral. And I was asked by a reporter for the Jewish Week about what I thought, because the Jewish press had an editorial denouncing this invitation, and I said something quite sharp about not going, said that the attendance at a prayer service in a place that contains Christian icons and in general raises the specter of idolatry, even though many Jewish authorities think that Christianity is not idolatry for non-Jews, but for Jews it is. I got a letter from the head of the Ecumenical Office of the New York Archdiocese, whom I knew a little, but I knew him. He was deeply offended by the use of the term idolatry. And I must say, I decided that he was right. It's a term that I have avoided ever since in discussing Christianity, because people take it to mean that the icons are gods, that you think that they believe that the statues are divinities, so I translate Avodah Zarah as foreign worship, and I use that literal translation rather than saying idolatry when I deal with Christianity, and I also use it with respect to Lubavitch the Ufires also. I avoided the use of the term idolatry. But among the things that he said in his objection was essentially, I'm paraphrasing, and it's a tendentious paraphrase, but it's not an unfair paraphrase. What he said is, after all that we've done for you in changing Catholic teaching to increase Jewish-Christian friendship, this is what we get in return. That you say that Christianity is, for Jews, even if it's only for Jews, idolatry. And if I would have said foreign worship, he would have been less emotionally engaged, perhaps, but it wouldn't change the basic objection. So this raises the issue of reciprocity, which the Rav raised explicitly. It's true that I got this criticism even though I spoke as an individual, but it's clearly taking place in the context of communal interaction, and these are real dangers.
Let's talk maybe more on a less communal policy level, more on an intellectual, spiritual level, about, in theory, how we as Jews should think about the obvious different faith propositions that constitute Judaism and Christianity. I'm going to sort of combine two questions because I think they're related. On the one hand, you have a book that came out in 2002 by Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks called The Dignity of Difference, and I'm not going to rehearse the editorial history of the book, but suffice it to say that the first edition contained language which began to move towards a position where other faiths were not simply validated for moral contributions, right, which is the usual way that Jews and Muslims sometimes talk about Christianity, that we respect the fact that this is a faith that has moral propositions, but rather, Rabbi Sacks began to entertain the possibility that other faiths reflected divinity and theological truth. And he writes, quote, that although in pre-modernity it was possible to believe that our truth, meaning the Jewish truth, was the only truth, our way the only way, that is not our situation today. God has spoken, he says, in modernity, to mankind in many languages, through Judaism to Jews, through Christianity to Christians, through Islam to Muslims. In heaven there is truth, in earth there are truths. So even though, if you follow the editorial history of the book, certain passages were excised because of pressure, but it's my understanding from talking to people who are close to the chief rabbi that he does think along these lines in some respect. I'm wondering how Jews should think about Christian truths, and I will put it this way. Do we think of Christian propositions about faith as ultimately entirely wrongheaded? You're wrong, I'm right, but I'll tolerate you? Or do we adapt a kind of position of indeterminacy regarding faith? Since faith is not something you can prove, I can't prove you're wrong and I'm right. I think I'm wrong. I think I'm right. I think you're wrong. But we'll see, since we cannot know, the possibility is that you are right, and maybe that tempers my intolerance to you. So in other words, I'm trying to understand intellectually how we could might think about these matters, even if we never talk about them with Christians. We'll start with.
It doesn't matter.
It's just that, matter. I think you mean Lord Sacks.
Correct.
At this point.
Correct. Lord Sacks.
I thought you just said that that we differ from Christians about attributing divinity to
We'll avoid talking about too much about Rabbi Sacks because we don't want to take the Lord's name in vain.
Yeah.
All right, go ahead. You start.
Question. Bernard Lewis wrote an article one time which was entitled, I'm Right, You're Wrong, Go to Hell. And his point was that specific religions, such as Christianity, at least for a long time, believed that correct beliefs was necessary for salvation, and those who were not Christians were going to hell. That was just a historical description. And then he said that whereas the Jewish people believe that even non-Jews or those who didn't know of Judaism can go to heaven. That's true. And then he said, the reason for that is that Jews believe that, I'm paraphrasing here, basically that because what you believe is true and what you believe is true. And that's a very bad mischaracterization, especially from a great scholar like Bernard Lewis. Judaism recognizes the fact that in areas of disagreement, there may be areas of agreement, and there may be, in other religions, about the state of humankind or in terms of our relationship with God, they may have great insights from which we can learn. But in areas in which we disagree, then sometimes there is no middle ground between right and wrong, and that there are issues about which Jews, we believe, are right and Christians are profoundly wrong, just as Orthodox Christians believe that there are issues about which they are right, and we are profoundly wrong. But the reason why I raised the Bernard Lewis issue is because Jews need feel and no shame in any of this. First, that's the nature of truth, but also, in contrast to other faiths, we have never maintained that those without full access to the truth are going to hell. And throughout the ages, to me, what's most striking is that you can have rabbis who were persecuted by anti-Semites and still write about the ability of all human beings to be given a reward in the world to come based largely on their free, Jew and non-Jew, on their free choice and the choices made in their lives and maintaining the rule, the Chassidu Mot HaOlam Yishlam Chelek LiOlam Haba. To me, that's an amazing aspect. And we should feel only pride, I think, in maintaining on the one hand that we believe that Baruch Elokeinu Shebaranu L'Chvodo V'Nasan Lanu Toras Emes, that we believe that God gave us a Torah of truth, and at the same time, with perfect pride in the fact that there were sages, persecuted sages throughout the centuries, such as Rabbi Akiva, who was still willing to say things such as Chaviv HaAdam Shenivar B'Tzelem Elokim, beloved are all human beings that are created in the image of God. And I'm willing, certainly, to put the Jewish record up against any other faith in this regard.
Okay, a few things. You quoted, I'm right, you're wrong, go to hell. Many years ago, in the early days of ecumenical dialogue, Newsweek had a story about a conversation or an alleged conversation between an old Catholic priest who didn't like this new fangled stuff and a younger one who did. And the young priest said to the older one, don't you think we should at least, you know, have discussions with them, which in this case meant, you know, Protestants really more than Jews. And the old priest replied, yes, we should have discussions with them. We're right, and they're wrong, and they have to admit it. So that's a conversation that has to take place. There are certain dangers of religious relativism that emerge out of interfaith discussion. And I've given one example of this in my exchange with this fellow from the Archdiocese of New York. First of all, let me underscore that I agree with Rabbi Soloveitchik's comment about learning from others. There are insights that religious insights that I think we can get from Christians in areas where Christianity has emphasized things that we have tended to, if not lose sight of, at least lose an appreciation of their centrality or their importance. Michael Visegrad, of whom Rabbi Soloveitchik is a fan, and in a certain respect, I am also, maybe not in every single way that Rabbi Soloveitchik is, but I am also a great fan, wrote an article on what a Jewish theologian can learn from Karl Barth. Without, you know, specifying exactly what these things are, There are a number of insights that I think one can really. I will give you an example that I cited once in a little piece, in a little appreciation that I wrote about Michael Visegrad. He said to me that people usually say that Judaism is a religion of works, emphasizes works, and Christianity emphasizes unmerited grace. Right? And that is a contrast that we think about, and that Jews have internalized also when they think about the difference between Judaism and Christianity. And he asked me a simple question. He said, have you ever met a Jew who entered shul on Yom Kippur and said, Lord, I want you to give me exactly what I deserve? And I never met such a Jew. And there are obviously Jewish texts that tend to recede in our consciousness, which discussion with Christians can bring to the fore. At the same time, I think it's very important to avoid the religious relativism that can arise out of this. I think that there are truths in other religions. Whether God revealed those truths through those religions is a very interesting question. The Rambam famously said that God seems to say that God brought Christianity into the world to make non-Jews and Islam into the world, to make non-Jews aware of the Torah. He doesn't say to impart truths to them, but to be aware of the Torah is to impart truth. So one could even say that from the Rambam's perspective, God imparted truth to non-Jews through Christianity and Islam. And I don't think that a reading of the Rambam is inconsistent with such a sentence. However, this should not lead to a formulation that says, maybe I'm right and maybe you're right, and we'll find out at the end of days. There is a story that I really dislike, or a line that I a fantasy that I really dislike, which has gotten much more currency than I wish it had gotten. And that is this notion. It's a sharp line. It's all very nice. You can smile at it. That at the end of days, when the Messiah comes. This is something attributed to Buber. I've never found it. They attributed to Elie Wiesel, attributed by Yitz Greenberg to himself with an extra line. Maybe it's only the extra line that he's attributing to himself. That at the end of days, when the Messiah comes, Jews and Christians will come to him and ask him, are you here for the first time or for the second time? Greenberg adds, and he would tell the Messiah to answer, I'm not telling you, to refuse to answer. And in a review of his book on Judaism and Christianity, I asked whether what he would say about the next question. Are you the incarnation of the second person of the triune God? Would he tell the Messiah not to answer that either? And this story was repeated by no less an Orthodox Jew and proud Jew than Malcolm Holmlein in the discussion about why we can accept evangelical Christian support. And a very distinguished Orthodox Jew repeated this in an RCA forum, an internet forum, which is confidential, so I can't say who it was, with approval. This is not a story that Jews should approve. These are issues that have divided Jews and Christians on the deepest level for a very long time. And the assertion that at the end of days you believe that your position will be verified with respect to key issues of difference between the religions is not, in my view, condescension. It does not assert that you... Christians who believe a doctrine that I believe will be revealed as untrue at the end of days are stupid. It doesn't mean that I'm smarter than you. It doesn't mean that I'm more ethical than you. There is, in my view, no condescension involved here at all. I think it's very important to maintain both the position that we can learn from non-Jews, even in religious matters, even to assert that God may have decided to reveal some truths to non-Jews through their religion, in the Rambam's formulation, but without speaking of uncertainty as to who is right.
Can I just clarify, would those truths that would be revealed to those non-Jewish faiths be truths that are not available to us?
No.
In other words, so just a different form of the same truth?
But perhaps with certain emphases that we might actually learn from.
Right. I would just add, I agree with that 100%, just to add another Michael Wischerkraut story, that Michael Wischerkraut once actually met Karl Barth, the great German theologian Karl Barth, for whom Wischerkraut had claimed a great fondness from and said that he learned a great deal about Judaism from studying Karl Barth. So, and he called himself, or people called him, something like that, a Jewish Barthian. So Karl Barth, who was an Orthodox Protestant Christian, thought that was funny, And he got into a discussion with him, and he said to him, he says, you know, you Jews, he said to Wishagrad, you Jews have the promise, but we Christians have the fulfillment. So Wishagrad responded something like, with all due respect, God's promises is not like other people's promises. When God promises something, that promise is like money in the bank. So if Jews have the promise, then we have fulfillment. And if we do not have the fulfillment, then we do not have the promise. There was a pause, and then Barth says, you know, I never thought of it that way. And to me, what I like about the story is that, and it shows me what I like about Visegrad, is that on the one hand, it shows a tremendous willingness to learn from Christian theologians. You can learn sometimes tremendously, tremendously rich things. At the same time, when push comes to shove, you have to be willing to say, this is what we believe. And that's that.
Okay. I wanted to move the discussion along to a more educational level, specifically how Jews should think about certain passages that are part of Jewish tradition regarding Gentiles. And all of us are aware that there are, you know, a number of passages in the Talmud and elsewhere that have a kind of anti-Jewish, anti-Gentile feel. And I'm wondering how the contemporary Jew should relate to this. Do we simply acknowledge them as accurate historical descriptions of the enmity that Gentiles bore towards Jews? Or I think that I've seen in education that there are certain, I wouldn't call them games, but there are certain strategies that people try to use when they're particularly uncomfortable with certain really sort of venomous anti-Gentile rhetoric, so they'll historicize them. So if it's Amalek, it'll be that was then, but it's not now. Or we can metaphorize them. We can say it's an archetype, it's not really a racial entity. But all of these, once you start sort of playing with text, there is a risk that you move them out of literal relevance into obscurity. So I'm wondering how you think we should think about these things today. And all of both of you are aware, of course, that our cultural conditions, our absorption of multiculturalism is far different post-Enlightenment than in any area of Jewish history. And along the same lines, do you think that this phrase, Esav Sonet Yaakov, is reflective of a certain animus within Gentiles that's permanent, that's not culturally determined?
Okay. It's a very big question. And let me sort of try to broaden it a little to make it worse. The formulation here has to do with specific passages to attribute evil to non-Jews, but there's an even broader question of Jewish laws that discriminate against non-Jews in the Talmud and elsewhere. So let me say a few things with ruthless brevity. First of all, I wrote an article about these issues in a volume with the absolutely atrocious title, Formulating Responses in an Egalitarian Age. It's an Orthodox Forum volume. I protested this title when I found out about it before the book appeared. But the person who was in charge, not the editor, the editor is Mark Stern, the person in charge of the series resisted changing this horrific title. So there it is. When Professor Gerald Blitzstein reacted to the article, he sent me a nice note about it. He commented about this terrible title. So anyway, but at least it's memorable. It's so terrible that it's hard to forget it. Formulating responses in an egalitarian age. Anyway, I wrote a piece called Jews, Gentiles, and the Modern Egalitarian Ethos, Some Tentative Thoughts. I tried to deal with these issues in somewhat different ways. So let me say this, as I say, with ruthless brevity. First of all, I think that certain expressions of hostility toward non-Jews are not dogmatically binding. They are not halacha. They are opinions. They are historically conditioned, and Jews, Orthodox Jews, do not have to embrace them. I cited in the article a really quite terrible quotation from the Ravid, And I wrote that if someone would say that today, I would be very upset with that person. When someone said that in the 12th century, it's different, and I can retain my reverence for the person who said it, even though I don't think that such an assertion is appropriate to make today. I don't believe that there is an inherent hatred of Jews by all Gentiles, if that's what Esav Sanias Yaakov is going to be said to mean. I remember when I once spoke about the Passion at the OU before it appeared, before the movie appeared a few weeks before. They ran a forum with Rabbi Skobach, who is from here, and Rabbi Weinreb and myself. We were all talking about a movie we hadn't seen, which I began by saying that I feel like Daniel, and more like Nebuchadnezzar, as wise men who were asked to interpret his dream, and they asked him, "What did you dream?" And he said, "I don't remember." And they said, "How can we interpret it?" He said, "You're wise men, you have to interpret it anyway." I was talking about a movie I didn't see. After the discussion, one of the people from the OU who was there, it was open to the public, but there were local OU rabbis there, and a man got up and he said, "There's nothing to discuss, there's nothing to talk about. The Esav Sanias Yaakov, that's all, period." I don't think that that's a binding statement that all non-Jews hate Jews. The difficult issues have to do with issues of discrimination and law. Sometimes law that involves not ritual. There's nothing wrong in my mind with discrimination with respect to ritual law, but there are great problems with respect to discrimination in civil law, in damages, and on and on. And here, I think that we are entitled to embrace the position of an impressive list of rabbis in the last century and a half who have affirmed their acceptance of the Meiri's distinction between the pagans of old and civilized nations. I think that we may and indeed we should, as a moral imperative, embrace that position.
Before you answer that question, I just want to frame it personally a bit for you. In your studies, have you come across people, fellow students, Christians, who are aware of these passages in Jewish texts?
That's an interesting question. I don't recall specifically having discussions about those issues, though. A professor at Princeton, who's not Jewish, but is a professor of Jewish studies, probably Dr. Berger knows, Peter Schaefer.
It was obvious whom you meant before you said the name.
I'm sorry? Yeah.
It was obvious whom you meant before.
Yeah.
Published
a book about the rabbinic writings about Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't had any discussions about that either. But that's the one case where it comes up. I completely agree with everything Dr. Berger said. As Dr. Berger himself writes, I think in the article, the approach that he's outlined is largely, I think, consistent with the approach of my revered grandfather, Avraham Soloveitchik, from whom Dr. Berger had learned as well. I say so about.
Yeah, actually, I should interrupt and say that there was a section in that article where I pay tribute to his impact on me in these matters.
Though you do outrageously, though truthfully, assert that he was a liberal Democrat in the 1980s.
Excuse me, I didn't use the word liberal, but I knew this would be a serious problem for.
It would be an outrageous accusation if it wasn't true.
Rabbi Soloveitchik, first of all, he admits that this is actually true,
I believe in truth, as you heard.
But he was discussing a Gemara that seemed to say that the lender is a tzaddik while the borrower is not, because the lender has money and therefore God rewarded him for his righteousness. And the borrower doesn't have money, so he must not be so righteous. And that's what the Gemara seems to say. However, the Gemara can be read to mean that was the view of the lender and borrower, but not necessarily the view of the Gemara itself, which was the position that Rabbi Soloveitchik took, and the way he formulated it, which did not sit so well with my colleague here, was, "Do you think the Gemara was a Republican?"
Answer is yes. No, I'm just kidding. I would just add that to everything Dr. Berger just said, what's striking to me when I consider anti-Gentile statements is actually, given the persecution that Jews went through, is how few they are. So I'll just give you a statement that I find mind-boggling. So let's take the writings on the Torah of the Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin. There's many statements about non-Jews that are just extraordinary. And he begins with opening his commentary by talking about Avraham as our model because he pleads for stone. And then in the passage where Esav hugs Yaakov, where he could so easily have said, oh, you know, he was whatever, trying to do something manipulative, etc. He says that this was a genuine embrace, and it is predicting of a time, to me personally, the Netziv's words are fulfilled, in my own view, in the evangelical Christian embrace of Israel, to some extent, certainly. But he says it predicts that there will be a time where Esav will actually love the Jewish people and embrace them because they are our brother. What strikes me is, you know, where was he writing this? I mean, he wasn't writing this in early 20th century Germany or in the Germany of Rav Shimshon or Paul Hirsch. I mean, he was writing this in essentially in the Pale, and where I'm pretty sure that if they saw a non-Jew coming at them with open arms, they were not going to assume that he was for a genuine embrace. And yet he wrote this. And to me, that's just one example, but an extraordinary one.
On the topic of education, and all of us who are in education know that there's limited time and there's limited energy and training. So you have to divide your priorities in terms of what should be taught. And I'm curious whether you think B'nai Torah should be taught systematically about Christianity, the history of Christianity, the theology of Christianity, given, as we all know, that in a 24-hour day, there's only so much time that you can devote to even Jewish topics, forget about other topics. If so, what would be the purpose of doing so? Are there pros and cons to doing so? And so forth.
Yes, but not systematically. In other words, I think that there is value in you're talking about B'nai Yeshiva. There is value in people who are going to be learned Jews in knowing the religion of their immediate environment. This is a practical concern. Jews should not be ignorant of one of the formative forces, one of the major formative forces of the civilization that surrounds them, whether or not it's a secular civilization primarily. It has been formed by Christianity in such a deep way that for knowledgeable Jews to be innocent of any knowledge, of any serious knowledge of Christianity is a deficiency. It is. I'm convinced that it's a deficiency. Now, there are also, but this is not such a compelling argument because there are many other areas like this, but there are also halachic issues that come up in the context of understanding Christianity. I am, like you, removed from being a posek, but in this area, I get shilas from rabbis. Now, of course, physicists get shilas from rabbis too, and chemists, and biologists, and doctors, so that, you know, you can't argue that all of these fields should be studied by potential rabbis. But nonetheless, this is an issue that really goes to the heart of understanding Judaism. Studying Christianity gives you an understanding that most rabbis do not have to the degree that they should of how one should define Avodah Zarah, which is one of the foundational concepts in Judaism. Through the prism of the study of Christianity, those Jewish understandings are clarified. Now, you know, as people know, I'm very concerned that this generation of Jews has abdicated its responsibility with respect to maintaining an understanding of what both false messianism and even Avodah Zarah is, to the point where the earlier question about, we have these fundamental obvious differences with Christianity, I'm not so sure that's true anymore. But the study of Christianity has important consequences, both in terms of understanding the society in which we live and in terms of understanding Jewish concepts in contrast to Christianity or in interaction or, sometimes subtle differences. It's important. I think it's even very important. But I'm not ready to say that there should be a required course in the smicha programs in Christian theology, in a systematic way. One has to, allocate time and resources carefully.
Just, I'm going to ask you a side question because of what you just said. I'm interested. And do you feel that Bnei Torah should learn about messianism and false messianism and even contemporary false messianism? Should that be actually taken up in the classroom, or should that be a kind of side discussion?
If it were taken up in the classroom from a proper perspective, look, I think that I have very, very strong feelings about this. I think that the Judaism, the Jewish religion, has been betrayed and undermined in the last 20 years. We can no longer say what we've been saying for 1,000 years about the differences between Judaism and Christianity, either on the level of criteria for identifying the Messiah, or even on the level of speaking about the Messiah as a divine figure. That means Judaism is undermined. It's not some element of Judaism that's elective. I think that the rabbinic leadership of this generation has abdicated its responsibility to protect the core of the Jewish religion. So given that I think this, I don't know how many people will say that they think this. I wish everybody would say that they think this. But given the fact that I think this, if I were empowered to make this point educationally, so I would do it. But I have at least some level of realism. I'm not I'm not about to have a required course in Lubavitch messianism.
I would just add to the question on the insistence on the value of studying theology, leaving aside the question of whether smicha students should be studying Christian theology, the question is sometimes whether we're equipping smicha students to talk about Jewish theology. And that's very critical. That's very critical. Nowadays, especially critical for rabbis, especially those representing orthodoxy, because orthodoxy is not just a series of practices, but a series of beliefs, to be able to talk about and defend what exactly Judaism and Orthodox Judaism believes. And I don't know that many rabbis today are equipped to do that. David Galernter has a wonderful line where he says that it used to be the standard question of Jews was, I want to be Jewish, but I don't know how. Tell me. So you have the codes of halakha, the codes of law, which tell you what to do as a Jew. Now, as a learner, you see from a lot of Jews, the question is not just, I want to be Jewish, but I don't know how, but rather, I want to be Jewish, but I don't know how. In other words, people nowadays in a free society want to know, well, do you believe as an Orthodox rabbi, obviously you believe, that Judaism represents something truer and therefore better, an approach to all sorts of issues. Why do you believe that? And Orthodox rabbis need to be able to explain and defend why they do that. In that sense, you could learn from Christians, because Christian studies, at least some, study systematic theology. So leaving aside the question of whether Jews should study Christian systematic theology, perhaps the first focus should be on how can we equip better Jews and rabbis to study a Jewish systematic theology.
I'm wondering if the two are connected. In other words, was there a hesitation on the part of Jewish institutions to talk about theology and pedagogically educate about theology because it was somehow perceived as a non-Jewish domain?
I don't know. My guess would be not that. I would just guess that, look, it used to be that Judaism wasn't a choice. Judaism was something before modernity. Something was assumed. Everyone who was Jewish decided to be Jewish. Either you left the community or you stayed in the community and you did everything. That's not how it works in a modern world. And the word orthodoxy is a modern term in the sense of that we believe ourselves to be the bearers of authentic, truest form of Judaism. And in modernity, we are saying we have the correct beliefs. And that's what we're standing for. And I think that is critical. And sometimes, at least I believe, as I've said on some of my writings, those why I believe Judaism has the best beliefs can be set out through a contrast with Christian beliefs, and sometimes not. It depends on the case and on the situation.
I just want to close, and we have Jewish rituals ahead of us, so those are our time constraints. By talking about whether you think there's meaning or efficacy to certain kinds of public exchanges between prominent Christians and Jews, I'm thinking specifically of a delegation of cardinals who visited Yeshiva University in 2004. They even visited the Beit Midrash, and there are other situations where there have been sort of interfaith prayer services where rabbis and other faith leaders of other faiths are involved. What do you think is the significance of these interchanges? Should there be more of them? Should we have priests lighting menorot and so forth? Is it just sort of window dressing? Is it symbolic good neighborliness? Or is there really something of religious significance to these things?
So let me say, first of all, that while you didn't have a lot of choice with respect to that delegation of cardinals the first time around. The second time around, there was care that they should, they didn't wear their vestment, they didn't wear their crosses openly in the Beis Medrash. These are very delicate issues. If you ask, in terms of the letter of the law, the rabbi of the synagogue in Rome, when Pope John Paul II, said that he was going to come to a synagogue, it was this great moment in Jewish-Catholic relations, obviously with his vestments and his cross. By the letter of the law, the rabbi of the synagogue in Rome should have said, I very much appreciate your desire to come to the synagogue, but I can't have you come in wearing your vestments and your cross. That's what he should have said by the letter of the law. Should he have actually said it? I'm not so sure he should have actually said it. This may be a case where the welfare of the Jewish people trumps the letter of the law. However, this is an issue of avodah zarah. We really can't lose sight of that. Avodah zarah is a very, very serious matter, and for Jews, Christianity, classical Christianity of this sort, is avodah zarah. To have a symbol of Avodah Zorah enter a synagogue is a very, very serious matter. It should be avoided if at all possible. Symbolism matters in halacha and even outside of halacha. I don't think there was anything wrong with having cardinals come to yeshiva and even to visit the Beis Medrash as long as there is no overt manifestation of Christian symbols. It is very important to try to keep good relations. These cardinals are interested in learning from Orthodox Jews specifically. I've had relations with these cardinals and bishops associated with them on a number of occasions. And one of them recently told me explicitly what I knew anyway. And that is that they want interaction with Orthodox Jews. They interact with non-Orthodox Jews. This was a French cleric who told me this. because, you know, they have to do it for good neighborly relations. They can't say we'll only talk to Orthodox Jews. But they're interested in talking to Orthodox Jews because they consider us authentic and they think that they can learn from us, and especially from modern Orthodox Jews, as to how to try to maintain a religious faith in a secular world, which they worry about a great deal in Europe. At the same time, when at all possible, I would resolve questions of participation in a prayer service appearance in a Christian house of worship, in the main sanctuary of a Christian house of worship, in the negative. I would have to be convinced that this is a matter of virtual pikuach nefesh in order to say that it's okay.
I agree with everything Dr. Berger said. I'll just add the following point, just about the cardinals visiting visiting yeshiva. There were two criticisms that was leveled against the question of the cardinals visiting yeshiva. One, which I think is the serious question, and that's the one Dr. Berger addressed, is the issue of rules relating to the Beit HaKnesset and bringing in objects into the Beit HaKnesset. And that's a very serious issue and has to be addressed either with the problem addressed or not addressed. Meaning, if the problem is not addressed, then it's a problem. If the problem is addressed, okay, then there is no problem. The other argument against it that you saw at Yeshiva and people writing about it, which I found odd, was that somehow the cardinals entering the Beis Medrash violated Rav Soloveitchik's guidelines on interfaith dialogue. And you heard that a lot, and that I found sort of strange. There was no major interfaith dialogue. All they did was basically walk into the Beis Medrash and become amazed at the fact that precisely what they have, to a certain extent, struggled and not succeeded to do, which is to transmit their faith in Europe to the next generation, Orthodox Jews were successfully doing. And somebody mentioned to me what most stunned them is that when they asked the students, and you have hundreds and hundreds of students studying Gemara, what most stunned them was the fact when they asked them, well, what do you plan to do? And they discovered that the people sitting there studying Gemara for several hours in an ancient text that was written thousands of years before were not all becoming rabbis. That these were going to be doctors and lawyers, accountants, and other jobs that Jews will do. All sorts of jobs, everything. These were laity. And they were here studying and wanted to make study of ancient religious texts in an ancient language a major part of their lives. In other words, it wasn't just they were impressed by Orthodoxy, they were impressed specifically by modern Orthodoxy in the way that Yeshiva University embodies it. And that aspect of it, I think, can give us a great deal, that aspect, once and only if, I think, the halakhic issues that Dr. Berger addressed are dealt with. Once those issues are addressed, I think we can actually take a great deal of pride from that.
Rabbi Soloveitchik, Dr. Berger, thank you very much. We have about 5 minutes for questions.
Go ahead.
There have been resolutions, for whatever they're worth, emerging out of Jewish-Christian discussions under the aegis of the Vatican and the International Jewish Committee on Interreligious Consultations, which is called ICHKIC. The abbreviation is ICHKIC. which contains within it representatives of Orthodoxy, Conservatism, Reform, and secular Jewish organizations, which makes the interdenominational dimension of this kosher for some Orthodox Jews who might otherwise hesitate to be in a group that's specifically interdenominationally religious. Regarding terrorism, regarding the fight against intolerance, the battle against terrorism, most of this, though, is consists of cliches. It's nice to have such assertions. At one point, there was even a statement, which is more than a cliche, that certain forms of anti-Zionism can be anti-Semitism, which was signed onto by a Catholic delegation, although it's the Catholics who work with Jews. It's not the Catholics who work with Muslims who said that. However, the level of concern on the part of Christians other than fundamentalist Christian evangelicals who don't engage in the kind of interfaith dialogue we're talking about in the first place, the attitudes toward the Islamic world is suffused with concern not to offend Muslims, not to offend Islam, not to be seen as painting Islam with a broad brush. And to a certain degree, I think these are legitimate concerns also. And so I don't think that interfaith dialogue is going to produce the sort of self-defense efforts that that you're alluding to.
Okay, we actually have to officially end because it's time for mincha. You're welcome to address it privately. Thank you very much.